From a small island off the coast of Sweden and a bigger island off the coast of Brazil, this is Stack Trace with me, John Sundell, and my good friend across the Atlantic, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
Hey, John, I'm doing great. I'm just curious, did you actually check for the how many square miles each island is?
I did not, no, but I just assume that your island is bigger because the one I'm on is really tiny. Like, we're talking, like, you can walk around it in 20 minutes, tiny.
Oh, yeah, no, mine is bigger than yours.
Right, exactly.
And that can't be taken out of context at all.
Right, exactly. Do not clip that part if you're going to share this podcast on Overcast.
Now people are going to do it.
Yeah, I know. That's how it works, right? So what are you up to on your slightly bigger island?
So I finally released the first beta of Chibi Studio 2.0.
Hooray! Congrats!
Yay. Yeah, so hasn't exploded yet. So I think it's good. Not that many issues. Mainly like, oh, this button has a white background, but it shouldn't. Just like, those types of issues. Those are right. The best types of issues.
Yeah, because those are the type of issues you really want to discover during a beta, right? Like, you don't want the app to always crash on startup or something, or you don't want, like, you know, the features to be super unstable or buggy or flaky. Like, you want there to be just this, like, small misses or small, like, configurations that you might not have run under or something like this. Like, you know, very minor things or edge casey things. That's a good beta.
Yeah, definitely. None like, I updated from the previous version and lost all my content type.
Right, exactly. That's when you hit the big red abort button, right? let's go back. Let's go back to Xcode. Yeah.
Yeah, I was quite scared because there's a significant migration that happens when you run it for the first time. So, yeah, fingers crossed. No issues so far.
Perfect. That's awesome. Would you say that customer sat is good?
Yeah, I'd say it's around 99%, so that's good.
That's perfect. Nice. So when you release a beta like this, like, what are your main objectives? Like, for how long are you going to run the beta? Like, are you looking for some specific feedback from people? Or how do you kind of use a beta testing phase kind of in your process?
So the main thing we want to know is, first of all, is the overall idea and design and structure of the app sound. That's kind of like the big picture, but also these small issues and issues that happen in configurations we don't test with. Like, let's say you have a 2016 iPad mini. There's probably not a 2016 iPad mini, but you get the point. Like,
right,
you use
older,
like,
hardware.
I mean, I do test it on an iPhone 5S running iOS 11, which is like the worst possible configuration you can run it on.
Yeah.
And it's okay. It's not perfect, but it's okay. But yeah, like, different configurations, different workflows. Some people like to do things in a certain way and the app might not work for them. And yeah, just overall, like, see if people are liking the app and if it's performing correctly. Catch like common crashes. We've had two so far that are like not, it's not like every time the app crashes, but it can, some race conditions here and there that could happen that could crash the app. And one of them is already fixed. I'm actually not using any crash reporting tool other than Apple's own crash reporting tool.
Cool.
Because it's good enough for what I need, and I don't want to put another framework into the app. We talked about this before.
Right.
This is a very much dependency-free app.
That's
as
awesome.
Much as possible. And yeah, there's also, like, we have localized in several languages, and I'm pretty sure the vast majority of people using the app are using it in English, but if there's like two or three people using it in the other languages that can give some feedback as to if the translations are good and if there's some truncation happening or some layout breaking somewhere because of the language differences, that would be cool. We did the translation with professional translators, but as you know, even professional translators can make mistakes and use the wrong word in some places.
Yeah, because depending on the language, so many strings are highly contextual, right? Like in some languages, saying like okay can be a different word depending on the context, or saying cancel can be a different word depending on the context. So it, sometimes it can be hard, you know. I've done some translations for some apps just for friends and things like that, and to Swedish. And sometimes it can be really, really hard to know like what word to use unless you have like a screenshot or some comment or something like that, which I personally always try to provide my translators when I do some kind of localization using some kind of, you know, freelancers or using some service that provides professional localizers. I always try to add that additional context if I can, so it doesn't just say cancel button.
Yeah, I am very verbose with the comment that you can give. So like there's a string, I'm actually looking at the strings file right now, there's a string that is this you? That's the, it's a question, is this you? And the comment is asking the user to flip a switch if the chibi in question represents themselves, asking if the current character on screen represents the user of the app. So that's a very descriptive text as to how this is actually used on the in the app itself. And the tool I'm using, the service, is called OneSky. It allows you to send screenshots. I haven't, because I think my texts are good enough. But there's also an option there to use your quote-unquote preferred translators, and those will be people who have worked with this app before.
Oh, that's nice.
So most translators have worked with Chibi Studio in a previous version, so they already have a little bit of context as to how the app works, and there's actually a description field you can give about the project itself, like, is this a formal thing, is this an informal thing, and what's the target audience. And also, you can have like a glossary of words. So, you, for example, the word chibi is a glossary word that the translator can click it, and it will say like, "Do not translate this. This is a term that's used in the app, and it means this, and it comes from Japanese and such and such." So, yeah, it's a very intricate process.
Yeah, totally. Localization is never just straightforward and easy. It always requires, you know, more work than you might think. And it's usually worth putting in that extra effort like you've done, because the quality of the translations will usually be so much higher.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm very happy with the results. I'm, of course, I can't judge many of the languages, but we'll see. And another thing I did is I translated to Portuguese myself before giving it to the translators. So during my work, I actually knew some places where it was not very good, like the description was not very good, and I managed to fix that before sending it to the translators.
Oh, that's perfect. The dog fooding, right? It always works.
Exactly. So what have you been doing, John?
So, like I mentioned, I am currently sitting on an island off the coast of Sweden, and it's not just for fun. I am visiting my parents, I've been visiting some family here, like my cousins and things like that. Just a little trip to Sweden, like I try to do every once in a while to, you know, visit my home country, since it's so easy to get between Poland and Sweden. So that's what I've been mostly up to, but I've also been playing around a lot with the Swift Playgrounds 3.0. So as we record, I believe it was earlier this week, Apple released a new major version of the Swift Playgrounds app for iPad. And as Stacktrace listeners will know, I'm a big fan of the iPad, and I also love to do coding on the iPad. But, you know, I'll admit, definitely, even though I'm a fan of the iPad, I'll admit that Swift Playgrounds has been so far quite limited, and I've developed some tools to get around some of those limitations, like Shapeshift, for example, is one such tool where you can easily bring a folder of Swift files from your Mac into Swift Playgrounds on the iPad, so that you can like work on a little bit larger projects than just a single Swift file. But now, with this new major release, they've added a lot of great new features for people like me who are not just like learning how to code, but who are actually using Swift Playgrounds as a development tool. So you can now super easily create new modules, which is, you know, kind of frameworks in Swift. You can easily add new files, you can move them around, you can rename them, you know, things like that that you are kind of taking for granted in an IDE. But of course, Swift Playgrounds is not like a fully fledged IDE yet. So it's kind of, you know, still a work in progress in that regard. Or I don't really know what the long-term plan is with this app, but I am loving these new features. I am feeling much more productive with them, and I feel like once I get used to them and I will use them in a good way, I will be able to do even more things on my iPad, which is kind of my goal. So I am going to publish a review of this app. This is going to be my first like product review that I think I've ever done. So I'm really looking forward to that.
And it's just 1 week after.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like 1 year after. So I'm having a lot of fun with that. And of course, a big thing that I'm still doing is preparing for WWDC. Hopefully on the next episode, which will be our WWDC poker episode, I'll be able to give you all the details around what exactly I'm doing for WWDC. But I think it's going to be great.
Awesome.
Cool. So let's get started with our main topics for this episode. And we're actually going to start this episode with some follow-up. We don't do follow-up a lot on this show, but this time we do have some follow-up around AirPods firmware. So tell us, Rambo, what have you found since our last episode?
All right. So we talked about, I think, briefly the AirPods, and I mentioned how the new AirPods are very different from the previous version. And they are actually quite different because the firmware for the new AirPods is more like a real OS. So they run a real operating system. And it's interesting that even though this is, as far as I can tell, a real-time operating system, it can actually run separate, quote-unquote, apps. So it has like an app for the audio processing, another one for the wireless communication, and it even has a built-in shell.
Wow, that's amazing. So you could theoretically run Vim on your AirPods.
Yeah, so this is something that's probably only available in development devices that Apple uses for testing and things like that, or in the factory before they are actually shipped. But yeah, they have a shell. So in theory, you could, I don't know, compile Swift code on your AirPods or something.
Imagine that. I mean, honestly, if someone would have told me just like 10 years ago that I would be walking around with a computer on my wrist that is able to, you know, measure my heart rate and run games and run 3D simulations and things like that, I would have said, no way. So when you say now, compile code on my headphones, you know, I'm like, Maybe I will do that in 10 years. Who knows?
Who knows, yeah.
So when you say that the AirPods have multiple apps, like, are those apps always running? Or does the OS, like, launch them and quit them on demand? Or do you know how that works?
I'm not sure how that works, but I believe that they run in parallel forever. Like, they're kind of like demons. They're always running.
Right.
It's still like an embedded thing that's just like a loop that keeps going.
Right, exactly. So it's almost like firmware, but just multiple pieces of the firmware. So the OS just like launches, boots itself up, and just launches all those sub-processes and runs them forever.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. So one thing I wanted to ask you around this is, Apple, they now have a bunch of different types of devices. And I'm not just talking iPhones versus iPad, etc. I'm talking like the different OSs that they have. Like, they obviously have macOS, iOS, but they also have products like the HomePod, AirPods, and the Apple Watch and things like that, which, you know, runs watchOS. But what do you see in terms of like, what's the difference between all these OS strategies that Apple has? And do you see any way that they would kind of come together, or do you think they will still remain separate for now?
I think it's using the right tool for the job, really. There's no point in having, say, watchOS running on AirPods, even though
right.
It could technically be done, I think. It's wasteful because you don't need all of that stuff. So I think it's really a matter of finding the right tool for the job at hand, and using what's best. Like iPhone runs OS 10 because it's got everything we need.
Exactly. It's got multitasking. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's about using the right tool for the job. But yeah, on iOS and the Mac, which are almost like the same thing currently, they are definitely working on bringing those together, mainly to make it easier for themselves and third-party developers to work.
Yeah, exactly. And that's more like, you know, it has more to do with software, right? And has, like you say, it has more to do with developer tools and things like that rather than the requirements of the device itself. Like something like AirPods has more to do with the actual hardware and the fact that the battery is like really, really tiny and you want that to last as absolutely long as possible.
Yeah, definitely. Battery life plays a huge part on defining what you actually run on these devices.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so with follow-up out of the way, let's move on to our first main topic. And this one is a little bit of breaking news as we record. For those of you listening, you know, several days might have already passed, but for us, it's brand new and we're excited. And it's that Apple, they just announced a new MacBook Pro. How about that, Rambo? A new MacBook Pro just dropping out of thin air. It's great.
Yeah, it's funny because it literally dropped as we were joining the call to record. So it is super breaking news. It was timed with our recording time, which is Apple time, 10 a.m. Apple time.
Exactly. It really pays off to record around that time because anytime they release anything, it's always around this time.
Exactly. Yeah. So this new MacBook Pro, it comes with a faster 8th and 9th generation Intel Core processors. And it's the first time that the MacBook Pro is available in an 8-core configuration.
Yeah, that's super exciting. It's really cool to see like the really high-end processors and these really like with lots of cores making their way into these super thin devices. You know, that's it's really, really cool to see. But of course, it's going to be interesting to see all the different benchmarks and reviews and results. Because as we know, like with such a tiny enclosure and thin enclosure, running such a high performance CPU can sometimes be problematic in terms of like heat and things like that. And, you know, we've seen before like these really high end CPUs being throttled quite quickly. So it's going to be really interesting to see like what actually this new MacBook Pro is capable of.
Yeah, and there'll probably be like those videos and articles about how Apple is throttling down the Intel GPU and it's not reaching its full potential, yada yada. But we can expect that.
Exactly. You just have to put it in the freezer for it to work. It's not a problem. Just, you know, work out of a freeze box and you'll be good.
Yeah. And there's something else different about this new device. Can you guess which part of the device is different, John?
I wonder what part of the MacBook Pro would they need to address the most? I think it's the color, right? The color is the thing that most people are complaining about, isn't it?
Yeah, there's no rose gold MacBook Pro.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the reason Apple is doomed. There's no rose color MacBook Pro. No, my serious guess is, of course, the keyboard.
Yes, so there's a new 4th generation butterfly mechanism with quote-unquote new materials.
Let's hope that the third times wasn't the charm, but the fourth time is the charm for this keyboard.
Hopefully, yeah. And to add to that, Apple is expanding its keyboard repair program. So if you are the owner of a 2018 MacBook Pro or even the latest MacBook Air, you can also take advantage of this program.
Yeah, that's really awesome. And that means that if you have a broken keyboard on a new MacBook Pro or the previous generation, you'll be able to bring it in and get a repair, and you'll also get the new keyboard, right? For free, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. So if you have problems with your keyboard that are covered by this program, which is basically like repeating keys not responding, keys flying off when you press them. I've seen that happen in front of my eyes. It's quite funny when it's not your machine.
Oh. Yeah.
So if you're having those issues, you bring it to an Apple store and they'll fix your keyboard for free, and they'll actually replace it by this fourth generation keyboard if you have one of the latest ones, like the one I have, which is the 2018 MacBook Pro with the third generation mechanism. They are going to replace it with the fourth generation mechanism, which is supposedly better and won't have as many issues. And they also said that they are streamlining the repair process in the Apple Store, so it's easier and faster to get this done, so you won't have to wait too long.
Yeah, it seems like what has happened here is probably that Apple has reached some kind of point internally where they've just said, okay, we need to get these keyboards out of the system, right? We need to replace them, we need to fix them, and it also kind of indicates that they are at least somewhat confident about this new fourth generation design, that they'll actually just replace it for free, and that it seems like they really want people to get this new design, because, well, that would just indicate that hopefully it will be more stable and less problematic for everyone involved.
Yeah, I mean, let's say the failure percentage of the current one is 10% and the new one is like 3%. That's a huge win for them. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be significantly better than the current one.
Yeah, exactly. So what do you think now that we've seen this MacBook Pro drop here just like a little bit more than a week before WWDC? Do you think we're going to see more hardware news before WWDC? Are we going to see like another week of shipping, or is this going to be it?
I mean, it's possible. There's still another week to go before WWDC. So yeah, I'm curious to see what happens tomorrow or today if you're listening. Maybe there's already another product launch. Actually, this week's episode might go out a little bit later if Apple releases something at 10 a.m. Apple time on Wednesday, which is when we usually release the episode. We'll have to delay a little bit to buried by Apple's hype.
Exactly. Yeah, it turns out there's both the positives and negatives to aligning your recording and releasing with Apple time.
Yeah. So, yeah, we'll see. But as we mentioned before, there are lots of hardware rumors and evidence of new hardware coming for WWDC. So they may prefer to announce them before if they have too much stuff to cover during the keynote. So yeah, we'll see. Super interested.
Yeah, absolutely. Because one thing that we are kind of anticipating to see on stage is some kind of preview or reveal or something, some news about the Mac Pro, right? The stationary Mac Pro. I'm really, really looking forward to seeing something about that. So that's something that they will probably say for the show, but that would make sense. Just like with the previous keynote, they kind of tried to get all the hardware news out of the way first so that they could focus the keynote on what they really wanted to show. And I mean, by the looks of everything, like all the rumors, your findings and everything, it looks to be a really, really big year in terms of software. So it would make sense that they would try to get some of the hardware releases, at least some of these like spec bumps and modifications and things like that, out of the door before the actual event.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so next up, we want to do this episode's edition of The Rambo Report. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's sponsor, which is our good friends at HP. You probably already heard of HP. They've been making computers, tablets, printers, and displays for a really long time. And at 9to5 Mac, we're super excited to have teamed up with them for our next deal of the month, offering some really great deals through HP's huge Memorial Day sale, which is going on right now. So if you, like me, want to use an external display with your MacBook or iPad Pro, then HP has got some really great deals for you. You can get products like the Omen X, which is a huge 35-inch curved display for a massive $350 discount, as well as big discounts on the HP Enview 34-inch and 27-inch displays, or why not double things up and get the dual 27-inch HP Pavilion display bundle for just $499. you'll also find a ton of great other deals on HP's printers, accessories, and so much more. So here's what you do. Open up the show notes in whichever podcast app that you're using right now. In there, you'll find a link that'll take you directly to this massive HP Memorial Day sale, where you can browse all of their discounted products, including the displays that I just mentioned. Please make sure to use that link, as it'll help support mine and Rambo's work with Stacktrace, and it helps keep new episodes of this show coming. Once again, head over to the show notes to find a link to HP's Memorial Day sale. Thanks so much to HP for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace. So now let's move on to the Rambo Report. What have you got for us this week, Rambo?
All right, so this week I have something very interesting, which is about CloudKit, best kit.
Yay, that's awesome. Our favorite cloud storage framework.
Definitely. So for those who are not familiar, CloudKit is a framework and a service by Apple that allows developers to store data in the cloud. And it actually backs many of Apple's own systems, like the photos in iCloud, the files, the iCloud Drive syncing, and also backups and voice memos app that syncs. Anything that's Apple that syncs is backed by CloudKit in some way. And there's something I found before, but today I had another look at it. And it all has to do with this new framework that was added after iOS 12. I don't remember if it was 12.0 or if it was like 12.1 or something. But it's a framework called CloudKit Code.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah. So I was having a look at this again, and it turns out that apparently what this framework has to do with is being able to run functions on CloudKit remotely. So you are able to write functions on the server, and you can invoke those functions using CloudKit on the device in your app.
That's really, really cool. Because not only is that a big trend in backend development in general, to move more towards this, you know, quote-unquote serverless architecture, where you basically have a set of functions that you can run on any hardware. So you can deploy them onto any cloud service, like the big ones like Google and Amazon and all these companies offers a way to run cloud functions on their hardware or in their data centers. And with this, it looks like Apple is going to join that with CloudKit. And that could be super interesting. And of course, my biggest question is, what language will we use? Will we see server-side Swift CloudKit functions kind of library or framework? Or will this be something like JavaScript or something else? What do you think about that, Rambo?
Yeah, that's something I really don't know. We'll have to see what type of code you'll be able to write there. It could be JavaScript, it could be even Swift, who knows, but it could also be maybe you'd have the option to choose between different types of code that you can write. So yeah, I'm not sure, but I'm sure we'll end up knowing someday. Not sure if this would be something for this year that they'll open up to developers, because it's just appeared and it's being used by very few of Apple's own systems. It's currently used for small things related to backups and to the Photos app. So it's not like a big deal at the moment. So maybe they'll want to dogfood it a little bit more before they open this up to developers.
Yeah, it almost looks like a beta test, right? And yeah. We talked about it before on the show that it seems to be Apple's general strategy around these type of things, especially like that has to do with iCloud and things that are like harder to fix after the fact. You usually want to get these things right the first time, because once people start deploying these kind of things in the cloud, you would have to have backwards compatibility and things like that. So it makes sense for them to test this internally first, maybe run this for like a year or something, and then reveal it at the next WWDC. But who knows, maybe they will surprise us and show us some CloudKit functions very soon. And especially if this is Swift, I do agree with you that I think that probably the most likely thing is that you will have some choice of language, because this is usually how these things work with other providers. But if we would get Swift CloudKit functions, that could be huge in terms of server-side Swift. Because, I mean, I don't know if CloudKit is used by that many apps outside of Apple or what the kind of adoption rate is. But just having something official from Apple where you can run your Swift code, you can deploy it super easily and run it in the cloud on the server, that could be great, like super cool, and could be a huge thing for server-side Swift.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Apple should definitely work on that and do some development for server-side Swift, because that's getting bigger and many people are already using it, but it would be very good to have Apple themselves supporting it officially.
Yeah, absolutely. And they do have projects like Swift Neo, which is a really big project on GitHub. It's an open source project around like the fundamental building blocks for building servers. So the most popular web frameworks, like for example Vapor, which I know you are using, Rambo, they are using Swift Neo in turn to perform like their low-level operations and handling requests and things like that, like accessing the file system. And I know also from speaking to Ted Kremenek on Swift by Sundell, he talked about that server-side Swift. On that episode, he said that it's used in production by Apple. So I'm excited where this is going to lead us. And another thing around cloud functions in general, which could be really powerful here, is that it would enable you for the first time to really run any sort of logic server-side with CloudKit. Because right now, all of the logic that is around like handling models, adding observations to records and getting notifications and things, that all has to be registered client-side. And it would be really powerful if you would be able to do some form of processing on this data server-side as well.
Yeah, currently the only way you can interact with CloudKit and do like this function type of thing is if you have your own server that talks to CloudKit.
Right, then you use the JavaScript SDK.
Yeah, you can kind of do it, but it's not as nice as just using something that's officially supported, and you could write functions in the CloudKit dashboard and test them. That would be really cool. And as far as I can see, they are scoped by a service and a function name. So you call functions by a service and a function name. So a service could be like Swift by Sundell, and the function would be get articles or something.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it would almost enable you, depending on how they structured it, but they could enable you to build like your own little REST API on top of CloudKit, right? Where in your code, in your app, you could basically like use that as your endpoints and get the data that you need, which would be awesome.
Yeah, and it would be very useful to, if you could say, and this is probably possible with what they're working on, like trigger a function to be executed every time a certain record type is created. So every type, right. Every time I add a new article record, I want it to call this function that does something, like calls a separate API to do something different. That would be really cool.
Yeah, exactly. Because so many times you want to create like multiple records at the same time. You might want to create relationships between records. Like if two users become friends, you want to create that friend connection. You might also want to store some data on the user records. And currently you have to do all of that stuff like client side in some kind of batch operation. But it would be really cool to be able to say, whenever the friend's property is modified on this user, also create like a friendship record, or also create like a shared photo album, or whatever your app is about. It would be really cool to be able to do all those things server-side and automatically, so that even though you might update your client-side code in the future, or different versions of the client might have different logic, your server-side logic would still be the same.
Absolutely. That would be really, really cool. So I'm looking forward to them eventually opening this up, because I, as you know, am a fan of these serverless concept, which is many people, complain about the serverless term, because it's not really serverless. You're not doing it without the server. But what that means is that instead of having this constant process that's running and listening for things, you spawn an instance of this function in the cloud somewhere based on it having to be executed. So just when you need it, it's there. And if you don't need it, it's not there. It's not running. And this is very powerful, and it can be, it can save time, and it can save money because you use less computing time. So I am a fan of this approach.
Yeah, and it also increases portability, right? Where, you know, depending on what kind of tools you use and things like that, but usually you can take your cloud function and move it from provider to provider, and it kind of just works, which is amazing. And this is not true if you are, of course, building your own server. Of course, you can use tools like Docker and things like that that enable you to move things more easily and to have things containerized. But when you have just a free function that you're calling, things are usually more portable and also more scalable because you are running these on huge data centers instead of just running it on your own machine or your own little box that you rented.
Yeah, definitely. And I've been using for some little things Cloudflare's functions. They call it Cloudflare Workers. And I've recently added a new service on top of that that you can call from Workers, which is these key value store. So you don't even need your own database. You can just store values in Cloudflare's own key value store. And there are separate APIs if you want to set a key from like another service or another server or your own API or app or something like that. So it's very interesting to be able to write small pieces of code that are basically just functions. They take an input and provide an output. It's a lot more simple than writing a full-blown web service where you are actually registering routes for each request and have persistent state. So it's very, very nice, and I hope it grows.
Yeah, me too. So really looking forward to see what will come out of this spelunking session and these things that you found. And I really hope that this will be a developer-facing API sooner rather than later with some form of cloud functions. And of course, big bonus points for me if it's in Swift, then I would be very, very happy. But that's not our only thing, this Rambo report. In fact, this is a bit of a funny one in terms of your findings, because it also involves yet another instance of your growing severity of your iPhone addiction problem, where you are buying iPhones left and right. So, Rambo, why don't you tell us, what have you been up to, and what is this thing I'm hearing that you've got yet another iPhone XR? What's the point?
So, I have a new iPhone XR, John.
Oh, geez. What have you done this time?
So, this time I bought a blue iPhone XR.
Oh, right, yeah, because the color is very important, like we established previously in our MacBook Pro segments.
Yeah, of course. So this is a blue iPhone XR, but the most important part is that it came running iOS 12.0.
All right, yeah, because you are a fan of the slightly older versions of iOS, I've come to understand.
Not really, but what happens is, for those who don't know, you have to, there's this thing called jailbreaking, which means using some vulnerability to run code as the system's kernel and circumventing Apple's protections of iOS. So you can run SSH and you can run any command you want and you can run any app you want and you can debug anything you want. So basically, if you can hack the system any way you want. And jailbreaking is usually available for previous versions of the OS because there needs to be a vulnerability that's discovered and then exploited to create a jailbreak. And of course, this type of vulnerability is super critical, so it's usually fixed fairly quickly. Not because Apple hates jailbreaking. I'm not saying they don't, but I'm saying they don't do it because of jailbreaking. They do it because it's a huge security vulnerability. If you can run a piece of sandbox code and start writing to kernel memory, that's kind of a problem.
Right.
And there's this other thing that Apple does, which is preventing people from installing older versions of iOS onto a device. So there's this thing known as a signing window. So Apple is signing the iOS version for this particular device model, let's say from iOS 12.1.3 to 12.3. And that's it. You can't install an older version of iOS. It's impossible because it involves code signing and encryption and lots of tricky stuff. So, and a server, a signing server. So what happens is if you want to jailbreak a device, you need to have a device in an OS version that's jailbreakable. And I already have an iPhone XR, but it's my beta device. It's the device I use to run the betas. So, of course, it's not in a jailbreakable version because it's running the latest 12.4 beta.
Right.
So, recently, a new jailbreak came out for iOS 12 to iOS 12.1.3, I believe, for ARM64 devices. Before, it was, ARM64E devices, so the A12 chip. Before, it was only available for ARM64, so you couldn't do it on last year's devices. So the new iPad Pro and iPhone XR, XS, XS Max, it wasn't possible. But now it is. So I got a new iPhone XR. I bought it from a place where I knew it had a high probability of having an older version of iOS. And I got lucky because it actually came with iOS 12.0, which is jailbreakable. So I jailbroke it using Chimera, I think that's how you say it. And it's actually a really nice app. These jailbreaking apps are getting nicer and nicer as time goes on. It's a really pretty app, and you just tap a button and you jailbreak your device.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. It's really cool to see also, like, the jailbreak community, like, when you see all these tweaks that are available and, you know, the design of the setup apps and the ones you use to actually jailbreak your phone. Like, I've never done that. Like, I've never been into that scene. I know that you are for obvious reasons. But I've just been, like, looking at it from time to time. And, you know, you can see a really big change in just the overall quality and just how much time people spend, like, polishing these tweaks and making them look really, really nice. And, you know, some of them are quite appealing. Like, when you look at them, you're like, I would like to see that in iOS proper, you know? Like, a lot of these ideas that the jailbreaking community come up with are really, really cool.
Yeah, definitely. So, as you know, I don't jailbreak for the tweaks. At least not mainly. I don't jailbreak because I want to pirate apps. I think most people don't. I jailbreak because I want to hack stuff.
Yeah, big surprise. So what have you been hacking?
So what I managed to do this time is I was able to get my jailbroken iPhone XR in a state where I can attach to any process using Xcode, like if I was the developer of the app. So I can download any app from the App Store, go in Xcode, select my jailbroken device as a target, go into debug, attach to process, and select the process there and connect to it. And then I can use the UI debugger and LLDB and all that cool stuff.
That must be like, you know, going into a candy store or something for you, right? Like, you get to see how all these apps are put together, like in terms of the UI and things like that. Like, you shared some screenshots with me where you were, you know, looking at the view debugger and you could see all the view controllers and things like that. Like, those things are always really interesting to see because I know that you've been using also like an image from the view debugger when you've attached it to Springboard in the past where you've shown, like, you know, people who say that you can't use child view controllers because they're too heavy, right? And then you have this image of Springboard and has all these view controllers and it's like, well, I think it's fine, you know? and these things are super interesting to see, like how Apple's apps are actually made, not on the code level necessarily, but on the UI level. Like, how does the view hierarchy look like? Like, how do they use child view controllers? How do they use different views, like stack views and things like that? And it looks like that's what you're now able to see in as many apps as you want, pretty much.
Yeah, it's like a Spelunker's Disneyland.
That's awesome. And it seems like you've just gotten a year pass, like an unlimited pass to your own version of Spelunker's Disneyland.
Yeah, that's true. And many people might be asking, but what's the big deal there? Because Can't you do that with a jailbroken device? You can do anything with a jailbroken device. Well, kinda, because even though the device is jailbroken, if you, all jailbreaks nowadays are semi-tethered, so basically, if you reboot the device, it's back to normal. So it's a normal device again. It's not jailbroken anymore. And there are limitations as to what the system will allow you to do from when it's in the just jailbroken state. So there was some setup involved to be able to do this type of debugging through Xcode. And I'm not sure it has been done before, actually, because before when I was debugging and when I was looking at articles about jailbreaking and how people were debugging apps, they were using these specialized tools for debugging that the jailbreaking community put up, like Scrypt, and there are these view inspectors you can inject into apps and things like that. But I have never seen anyone actually use Xcode in this way. So I think it's quite neat.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. It's always awesome when you can use your native tools in a context like this, because like you mentioned, so many times it just involves doing some hacky workarounds or, using some custom built tool. But once you can actually get access to the real debugger and to put everything in there, that must be really, really liberating. And you must be able to do way more things with those powerful native tools.
Yeah, something that's just happened. It's not directly related to this debugging thing, but I was able to run Swift Playgrounds on iPhone.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's a dream of mine, to have Swift Playgrounds on the iPhone. That would be amazing. I would be so productive all the time. I would be writing Swift code in the elevator. It would be great.
Yeah, it's not quite working perfectly yet, but I think I might be able to make it sing. We'll see.
All right, I'm really looking forward to seeing what you'll be able to find now that you've entered your Spelunkers Disneyland. And we're definitely going to have future editions of the Rambo Report influenced by this, I'm sure. And I'm also really curious, like I mentioned, to see the view hierarchies and things like that from some popular apps or some apps that, could be interesting to have a look at. But now let's move on to our final segment of this episode, which is, of course, Ask Stacktrace. So as you know, you can ask us any question that you want by tweeting into Twitter, wherever you want, with the hashtag AskStacktrace. And when you do, we'll pick up that question on some future episode, and hopefully we'll be able to answer it. But we're going to kick it off here with a question from Richard. And Richard wants to know, when or if do you think that we'll see Xcode on iOS? So I mentioned before in this episode that I'm a huge fan of the iPad and using Swift Playgrounds. And, of course, I would personally love to see a more fully featured version of it, call it Xcode, call it Playgrounds Pro or whatever. I would love to see that. So what do you think, Rambo? Is this something that you think Apple is working on? Do you think we'll see it this year, some other year, or ever? What's your thoughts?
So there are two questions. So the first one is if, and the second one is when. So the if, I think we can pretty much say yes. I think it's inevitable that it will happen eventually.
And not only on an infinite timescale, right? In a within our lifetime timescale.
Yeah, so that's we got to the when question, and that's the tricky one. So I think if I had to guess, I'd say not before at least 2020.
And do you think that has something to do with things like the ARM transition or more maturity of things like Marzipan, and so that they would be able to share more infrastructure across platforms? Or why do you think that 2020 and beyond is the time frame?
There's the aspect of everything on the same architecture, but also the OS having support for that. And I think the iOS operating system really needs a more powerful developer mode that allows us to do more stuff than we can at the moment. Allows us to, why not SSH into the device and maybe not remount the file system as a read-write, but maybe just read stuff from the file system. to debug. That's super handy when debugging. I use my jailbroken devices in that way. I sometimes, like, I want to see something in the apps container, and you can do it. Yeah, you can do it through Xcode and some other tools, but it's always kind of clunky and slow. It's much easier to just ls and list the files. So I really hope we get a more powerful developer mode on these devices. You have to be like a paid Apple developer, and you have to like accept this huge license agreement that if your device explodes, it's not their fault. But yeah, I think we need something like that to allow for a really, really powerful IDE on iOS.
Yeah, and just to enable things like shell access, right? Like, so many developers use the terminal and the shell in order to do actions. And not only SSHing into a device, but running the terminal locally on the device. Like, I would love to be able to use a native shell on my iPad to move files around and do all these things. And there is this project called OpenTerm by our friend of the show, Louis Dehauve, who now works for Apple, funnily enough. And that's a great project. I mean, you can do lots of cool things with it. But, you know, having that, like having terminal.app, like the real full-blown terminal with that level of access on your device, even though it might be somewhat sandboxed, right? I doubt that we'll be able to get like full root access, but just being able to move things around and, you know, have some higher level of sandboxing so that you could perhaps move files from one app container to another app container or from into iCloud Drive and things like that, like those kind of things would be so great if we wanted to make the iPad more of a fully capable development machine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I do agree with your time frame. I think that this year would be a little bit stretching it too far. I would be extremely surprised if we see something like that this year. But I'm pretty sure that something like this is in the works. And of course, as the iPad is advancing and more pro use cases are unlocked on the iPad, being able to do proper, quote unquote, proper iOS development on it, like using an Xcode project, launching separate processes, debugging different apps running on the same device, like those are all things that would be super great to have. And I'm sure that Apple would love to see that as well. I think it's just a matter of actually building that out and finding the right security models and the right sandboxing models in order to enable these more like lower level developer features like something like Xcode would use.
Yeah, definitely. Like something I would love to be able to do, but it's a little bit tricky, is I would love to be able to write the Chibi Studio Chibi editor in Playgrounds on my iPad, because the iteration there would be so quick. Like I just changed something about how a gesture works and I test it right away. But the problem is the structure of the code is such that I would have to have like a whole separate setup to be able to do that, because there's a hierarchy of frameworks involved, and you can't have frameworks on Playgrounds. I mean, I could use your tool, but it's like multiple frameworks that import each other. So and that's not like because my project is hacky or anything. That's like a common thing that you do when you have your project modularized.
Yeah, and you probably have build settings and things like that and scripts that you run, and you know, those would all have to be figured out somehow.
Yeah, there are scripts, there are bundles of assets that are needed. So yeah, I hope they figure something out there to make this easier for us.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's move on to our next question, which comes from Alex. And Alex wants to hear what our take is on building a Hackintosh. So those of you who don't know what that is, it's when you basically build your own computer and you run macOS on it. And this is obviously not supported. You know, this is not something that Apple encourages or provides, but it is possible, at least in certain configurations. So he asks, is it okay to use Hackintoshes instead of actual Apple hardware? And are there any obvious shortcomings or advantages? So I personally have never built a Hackintosh, mostly for the same reasons as why I don't jailbreak, because I'm not just that into that particular scene. And also I use my devices a lot just like tools, like, you know, doing my work. So I would love for them to just be as stable and as easy to use as possible. So I've never really gotten into the Hackintosh scene, but that seems to be more like up your alley, Rambo. Have you ever tried to build a Hackintosh?
I fiddled with it way back, like during the Leopard days, I think, mostly because I wanted to see how it worked, but not because I actually wanted to use it. And the question, is it okay to use in lieu of actual Apple hardware? I would say the answer is no, because the result you get is a pretty unstable machine. I've never seen a Hackintosh that's like stable. It can be even faster than a regular Mac. I'm not talking about speed. You can get amazing speeds. The problem is stability, and there are usually things that don't really work, like Bluetooth LE usually doesn't work. Like I've had people who try to use AirBuddy in Hackintoshes, and it doesn't work because it requires some specific features of the hardware. So the shortcomings would be that hardware-specific things don't work, like Bluetooth LE. You can get like a dongle, but you won't get the same experience, of course. The advantages, if you ignore the stability issue, you can get a Mac a computer that runs macOS that's just like you want it. Like you can have whatever amount of RAM you want, whatever processor you want, whatever graphics card you want. Of course, you need to find compatible parts, but there are lots of them. And yeah, you can have a very powerful computer that runs macOS for a lot less than Apple charges for a Mac. That's definitely true. But the price of the Macs is it has a reason. It's not just because it has the Apple brand. Of course, that's a part of it. But there's the materials that are used. There's the quality assurance that there is, ignoring the keyboards. There's lots of things that go on into making a Mac that's not just put these components together and connect them, install the software, and that's it. Like, if you're talking about a laptop like my MacBook Pro, they calibrate the screens individually, so every single screen is perfectly calibrated and you're not going to have issues with the colors being off or anything like that. So there are reasons why Macs are expensive. Also, they are aluminum, which is quite a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Another common issue with Hackintoshes is when you are relying on Apple services like iMessage, for example, or iCloud and things like that. Like some of those services have sometimes a hard time running on Hackintoshes. And the whole thing you mentioned around stability, like we're not talking about the stability of the hardware here, obviously. And like you mentioned, you can build fantastic machines that are Hackintoshes that are super fast and have great GPUs for a much lower cost. But at the same time, like the stability here is when you update your operating system, everything could just break, right? And this is something that everyone who I've ever talked to who has a Hackintosh says, like, you know, they're dreading that update button. Like, you know, they don't know, like, if I click this button, it might just make my whole computer not work anymore. And like I mentioned, my main objective with all of my computers is like, I want them to be as stable and just as easy to use and as reliable as possible. And Hackintosh for me, like while it would be super cool and fun to do that as a project, I wouldn't want to use that as my main machine because I would just be scared all the time that it would just suddenly stop working when I need to like record a podcast or write an article or something, which just would make me be scared and stressed all the time.
Yeah, and you know, I am super happy with betas. Now that I have test devices, I don't actually install iOS betas on my main device. And also on my Mac, my main Mac, which is the 15-inch MacBook Pro, I don't install betas. And I even wait quite a while before installing new OS releases. There's been a new Mac release recently, Mac OS release, and I'm currently looking at a little badge in system preferences because I haven't installed that yet. Just because like things can break and I need this machine to work, so I usually do it like during a weekend, like on a Saturday, so that if there's some issue, I can like take the entire weekend to fix it if needed, because I really need my computer to be reliable and to be able to work with it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just to give you an idea, like I took maybe 6 months before I updated from High Sierra to Mojave. So the chances of me running a Hackintosh are very, very low if you think about that. But then again, like I'm not against it, and I think it's super cool that people do it. And if I had a different set of priorities and I was more into this, like, you know, building your own computer kind of scene, I would definitely build a Hackintosh. It seems like a super cool project. It's just, you know, it depends on what your priorities are and what you need from your computer. But now let's do our third and final question for our Ask Stacktrace segment. And this one comes from Josh. And Josh wants to know, if me and Rambo could go work for Apple and had the choice of any job that we wanted, what would we work on, or what would we try to get a chance to fully understand? So I think this is a great question. In a parallel universe, when you and me, Rambo, we work at Apple Park, and we work on something at Apple, what would you work on?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't pass the whiteboard interview.
Right. Or the security check, you know, in the office where they have pictures of you, says most wanted, do not let this man in.
Yeah, but let's say in a parallel universe, I would want to be a UI engineer, and I want to probably work with UI engineering on Spring Board.
Right, exactly. So build the actual user interface for the main iOS for Spring Board, like the app launcher and multitasking window and things like that.
Yeah, like work on the main iOS experience, which is Spring Board. I think that would be super cool for me. And UI engineering in general, because that's, if I had to choose, like, do you want to work on like backend, like model layer type of code, or would you like to work only on UI code? I would choose UI code, definitely.
That's cool, because I have a very, very different dream job in that sense. And I would work on developer tools, of course. You know, like I would love to work on something like Swift Playgrounds for the iPad, or on Xcode or some specific parts of it, or definitely something related to Swift I would love to work on, and something that would really have a big impact on the user experience. Yeah, something to make the life of developers easier and more fun. And another thing that I would love to see, and this ties into the second part of the question, is, you know, how all these things work under the hood. Like, obviously, the Swift compiler is open source, the Swift standard library is, like, there's a lot of things that are coming out of Apple now that are open source that we can look at the implementation, and I'm always doing that. I think that's super interesting to look at. But I would love to see, like, what does the code base for Xcode look like? How does Swift Playgrounds code base look like? Like, how does the intercommunication between the compiler and the IDE look like? Like, all of those things I would love to learn more about. So that would be my choice.
Yeah, that would be cool. I think that would probably be my second option. If I had to choose like a second option, it would be definitely working on developer tools. I would want to work on Xcode for iPad. There you go.
Xcode for iPad. Yeah, we'll sign up for that.
Okay, Apple recruiters, call us.
All right, so this has been a blast, a very fun episode. So next week, we're going to have a very special episode. We're going to do our WWDC poker. So for those of you who have been around now for a while, you know that our preferred way of speculating what a keynote will look like and what will be announced is to play poker around it. So we'll see you next week for that episode. Until then, you can find us on Twitter. I am at John Sundell. Mr. Rambo is at _inside. You can find all of Rambo scoops and writing and reports at 9to5mac.com, where you can also find the show notes if you don't have them in your podcast player. In the show notes, you can also find the link to buy some really great products from HP. You can upgrade your monitor setup and get some good deals on that, so make sure to check that out. And if you want to find my writing, you can head over to swiftbysundell.com for that. But that's it for this episode, so say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.